Chapter 6, Leaders in LED. Here I stand, I can do no other. Martin Luther. The history of humankind appears to have been one long struggle for justice and the recognition of our humanity by those holding the whips. The tiny number of networkers making up the power elites have dominated the masses for thousands of years and will continue to do so if we allow them to. No revolution is needed, and I only advocate peaceful solutions as these can be readily achieved with the requisite will. However, if the controllers imagine that they can carry on as they have always done, then we must all prepare for the continuing loss of our liberties or an equal and opposite response. This is why I have committed so much time and expended so much effort over recent years on the projects I am involved with. If the reasonable and effective changes that I put forward are not adopted, or some equally democratic and liberty-protecting alternatives are not taken up, then so be it. At least I tried, and the decks will have been cleared for what follows. The rise of our elites to supremacy cannot be exactly dated, but there is evidence that it was underway among hunter-gatherer groups even before farming began. In recent years, archaeologists have found sophisticated stone buildings and temple-like structures at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey that were erected over 11,000 years ago and long before man began to harvest crops. There are several other sites in the region, and some may be as much as 2,000 years older than Göbekli Tepe. Why did these hunter-gatherers come together to expend huge effort constructing the impressive structures and raising the large carving-covered T-stones found at Göbekli Tepe? Who led them to think that these efforts were worthwhile? Who managed to organize them in order to see the projects through to fruition? The leaders must have been very persuasive and their arguments convincing, but we can only guess at what inspired the workers. What it does show is that the separation of the members of the tribes involved into a leadership class and a subordinated one must already have taken place before the work was contemplated. Those with the conceptual and practical capabilities to guide the project must have been respected or feared enough for the others to carry out the work at their behest. It looks like the cradle of Western civilization may have been one of the earliest places in which man began his more formal separation into its two most significant groupings, the leaders and the led. I think that the leaders simply had more belief, first in themselves, or secondly, in some spiritual power. I could be wrong, as all of us are only guessing when peering so far into the past. Whoever motivated the builders to build must have had a confidence about them that set them apart. That self-belief can be based on physical capabilities or mental powers, and this is where you find the natural leaders. Man's drive for power may just be the natural outcome of this sorting mechanism, the confident and capable being the first in the pecking order. The rest are just the spoils, the admiration of the other men, the thrill of leading, which I can attest can be very powerful, and the power that comes with it. Such a separation at that time appears to have been uncommon, but whenever and wherever it happened, it must have been a significant step, not only in the development of the tribes and the peoples involved, but eventually for all of us. The split into an elite capable of conceiving plans and directing significant construction teams may explain the genesis of Western and other civilizations. Unfortunately, the downside of this is the arrogance of some of them as they moved ever further from their common roots. This division has naturally been compounded by family links, as favors are bestowed on blood relatives and resentments festered. Dynastic founders have often been particularly gifted and deserving of their position as leaders and innovators, but over the generations, the same vigor to Viagra decay that strikes down empires sees the climb of another family to replace the waning stars. In some tribes in the past, we have records showing that the election of leaders took place, but bloodlinks no doubt played their part in this too. Leading families probably grew into a local aristocracy, such as became the case with the senatorial families of the Romans, which over the centuries retained an inner core of great families. Crawford, 1992, p. 23. The first direct democracies, those in ancient Greece and Rome, saw the uneducated taking part in the political decision-making processes. However, many leaders and their families soon forget that their origins also come from within the mass, believing that they truly are special and deserving of the worship or fear of the citizenry. If the scales were not tipped in their favor, their children would soon enough probably slip back to where they came from. Interestingly, in recent times, these ancient regimes were much admired by the classically educated elite in England. However, what they often skated over is that the glory that was Greece and the power of Rome were in good measure due to direct democracy giving those states the vibrancy that separated them from the closed leadership groups that they defeated. Crawford, 1992, p. 193. The propensity for the elites in Britain to pull up the ladder was demonstrated soon after the Romans departed, and we entered the Dark Ages. Anglo-Saxon and Romano-Britain warband leaders were well ahead of the modern spin doctors, making full use of an early and highly effective form of PR to retain control of the Great Hall. In essence, the use of genealogies became an effective method, like panegyric poetry, by which members of the dominant family or social grouping could enhance their status in relation to other members of the warrior aristocracy. Evans, 1998, p. 45. The rough-and-ready world of the warbands lasted for centuries, but civil society and the state would begin the slow process of change after 597 CE, when Christianity took hold among the Anglo-Saxons. The Pope sent Augustine, a monk, to convert the pagans, and the church started schooling local children to provide future priests and administrators, giving poor but able children a way to progress outside of the warbands. While the church played an advisory role to the secular leadership, some leading families had their children educated alongside the poor scholars, and no doubt these were favored for their access to power. As the schools were few and the poor scholars limited in numbers too, the powerful were still able to keep the peasants ignorant, and this remained largely the case for another 1,000 years. Today, we still have an arrogant few very effectively playing this game, using their financial strength to maintain their exalted positions, with their control of the political pygmies guaranteed through funding their campaigns, without which they can never rise to prominence, particularly in the US. This was why Trump could go up the escalator, as he had no need of their dirty dosh. And look what they are doing to him. The scales are weighted in their favor, and if a threat is identified, it is snuffed out or neutralized. This propensity for a hard core of those in power to benefit themselves is often due to innate and unusually strong drives that are common to some odd breeds, the utopian visionaries, the psychopathically inclined, and the narcissist oddballs. In the worst cases, utopians come to dominate the power structure, and we end up with a totalitarian regime, which is where our representative democracies are heading if we don't stop the slide. In the financial world, Gresham's law states that bad money drives out the good, and it seems to me that this can be applied to social science too, with the conscienceless, manipulative, and driven types finding the power system a great hall, feasting venue made for their like. This domination of the many by the psychotically enabled few in totalitarian regimes has even been given a name, ponerology. Polish and other Central European psychologists and scientists coined the term when they noted the prevalence of disturbed people in the bureaucracies of the Soviet regime. Andrew M. Lobachevsky wrote of the findings in Political Ponerology, The Science of Evil, Psychopathy, and the origins of totalitarianism, as he lived in the testing ground in which he and his fellow observers were unfortunate enough to watch the sickness grow. Just like a doctored virus might in a laboratory today, sadly, it is not only in totalitarian states that those who justify cold-blooded culling can be found. Herbert Spencer was a liberal philosopher who, apparently after reading Darwin, coined the phrase survival of the fittest. However, 9 years before Darwin had published Origin of the Species, Spencer had set out his thoughts on the race question when he wrote in Social Statics in 1850, "The forces which are working out the great scheme of perfect happiness, taking no account of incidental suffering, exterminate such sections of mankind as stand in their way, be he human or be he brute. The hindrance must be got rid of." Anthropologists and historians have offered many theories about our lives in the past, but these are based upon less solid material than those of archaeologists and DNA samplers. The latter can now even recover DNA for analysis from 400,000-year-old remains, including a Homo heidelbergensis sun worshipper in Spain. Reich, 2019, p. 71. Though the life story of this hominid is unknown, the mass collection and analysis now underway is adding to our knowledge of the past, much beyond the very recent paper records of our more recent ancestors. All these analysts are supposedly trained to objectively analyze their subjects, but not only do the written materials they study naturally reflect the biases of the cultures and eras of the subject under investigation, the same is true for those of the investigators. I have stressed supposedly because the truth is that a good number of those training students over many generations have been as agenda-driven as a CCP culture warrior in Mao's day or a race-grifting lightweight in an Ivy League indoctrination center today. Even without the conscious misdirection of the committed agenda-setters, errors and differing interpretations abounded. However, at least archaeology and DNA analysis have helped provide new evidence that can bring into question theories with significant ramifications that were peddled in the past, often for political reasons. As new evidence has piled up, the list of deliberate efforts to hide the truth and to push myths to mislead the public has grown, yet many authorities still cling to false narratives upon which reputations, careers, and livelihoods have been built. No surprise, I suppose. In recent decades, the most famous anthropologist of all time, Time magazine's Mother of the World in 1969, Margaret Mead, was exposed as a dupe. She had been misled by the young women she studied on Pacific Islands into thinking that they had very open sex lives compared to that of Americans. She and her politically motivated guru, Franz Boas, one of the other greats in anthropology, may also have wished to shock the conservative nation and make it more progressive. Wrangham, Richard, Patterson, Dale, 1996, PPP 97, 107. Now, you can have your view about these things, but misusing science to do so is not the way to go about it. Hence the suspicions many of us now have, not only of science itself, but of its proponents as well. Anyone who thinks wokeism is recent has not been looking too closely at the academic world over the past century and more. These revelations about Mead and Boas and their political machinations should have shaken the American Anthropological Association to its core. But no, they are still lauded. Academics, too, it appears, can be too big to fail. An honest mistake can be countered by accepting the facts, but a dishonest one that is not confronted will lead to more and worse. Moral hazard is not only a banking problem, it is a cultural one. When academics and the elite in general do not have to learn from harsh lessons, because they never really get one. 19-year-olds from West Virginia received theirs on some field in Vietnam or some mountain in Afghanistan, but not Hunter and his ilk. Even worse, Mead made a famous remark, which I will leave you to read into it what you will. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. Whilst she acknowledged that rape did occasionally take place in her Samoan paradise, it was surely the fault of contact with white civilization. With ideologues like these becoming the mother of all of us and working from the inside to destroy the good as well as the bad from within by using fake science, what hope is there for the West? I remember reading about Raphael Lemkin and his draft of the genocide law, in which he set out to defend from eradication not only the people, but also their cultures. Thus, he included cultural genocide in his draft, but this was not reflected in the Genocide Convention passed by the UN back in 1948. Can you think why? Mead and those like her who want to change the world to meet their specifications might give a hint, and I will be covering this later in more depth in Chapter 11, The Lucrative Racket. Soldiers earned the freedoms these clowns benefited from, and whilst the former could pay with their lives, the latter don't even lose their reputations or their grasp on their pathetic tenures. Civilizations, like all organizations, rot from the head, and today we see democracy being shaken to its core, but it is no use wringing our hands and looking for another charismatic savior. Forget it, it is down to us. Over a century ago, two Italians, Vilfredo Pareto and Gaetano Mosca, became known for their analysis of the recycling of the elites. This suggests that fresh blood is infused by the ruling group to keep rising elites quiescent, and if this fails or is not undertaken, then the complete takeover of a faltering vanguard by a vibrant one will follow. This was covered in a similar vein by Plato in his foundational work, The Republic, in which he advised that guardians of a philosophical elite must run things, he being one of them, of course. These theories have been readily accepted by the chosen few who study such works, as the findings of this political philosopher justify keeping them, mostly, in place. As noted earlier, they avoided the lesson of the rise of the Roman Republic, powered by the plebs, who kicked out the king and then had to battle the 100 patrician families that monopolized power for hundreds of years. The plebs, like the Shudras, the lowest in-caste of the Hindus, were deemed a hereditary group, so they had to battle to get any chance of progressing upwards. What was the incentive for any elite to elevate the many by educating them as to such a historically proven alternative? The early American leaders also understood this, and it was only after the Republic was established that the states and municipalities began the long process of introducing the tools of direct democracy. Today, 49 of the 50 U.S. states require a referendum to alter their constitutions, but the USA has never had a national advisory referendum, which it could do even under the present constitution. Could some regular feedback such as these might provide not help resolve some of the divisions and issues ripping the place apart today? You bet they would, but that would tear the power from the hands of the lightweights feeding out of the campaign funding trough, so it ain't happening unless you, my American friends, do something about it. The examples cited here demonstrate the mendacity, corruption, and cowardice of these elite groups. This is why so many of the lower orders reject climbing the greasy pole. It is not popular with their families and friends. It is understood you may have to make the moral sacrifices required to fit in with the weaklings willing to compromise all just to be accepted by powerful crooks. Even the army is not immune to this form of moral corruption. And I remember watching social climbing officers, I refer to them as cocktail colonels, when drinking with even more senior officers, schmoozing like a lobbyist with Mitch McConnell and paving their paths to the stars and the swords. This is what leads to many failures in procurement programs as the self-servers make ready for their next career, lining up roles as arms company employees and board members. They can do so by avoiding too many awkward questions and complaints in the development programs undertaken by those companies with which they hope to find work. hence the expensive Air Force aircraft toilet seats. Similar institutional faults to those noted above concerning anthropology have been found in archaeology. I remember reading Constant Battles by Stephen LeBlanc, which completely exposed the poor and again politically directed analysis of those digging into the past. Thankfully, the author was honest and explained that he and his fellow academics had for generations misinterpreted what they saw with their own eyes. This had largely been due to their desire to sugarcoat the behavior of past generations around the world, especially in those parts of the globe which had been colonized by Westerners, of course. We can forget the Muslim imperialists who had a 1,400-year empire affecting nations from Turkestan to Spain, and the Arabs who had territories in East Africa that they had subjugated even before the Romans appeared on their horizon. These leading brains wanted to believe that mankind was not violent, accepting, no doubt in many cases in order to get ahead, that where man became more violent, it was down to the usual suspects. The author of Constant Battles was brutally frank in his admission of his failings in this regard, a rare instance of such honesty and well worth the read. I will quote a few of Mr. LeBlanc's candid pointers. The common notion of humankind's blissful past, populated with noble savages living in a pristine and peaceful world, is held by those who do not understand our past and who have failed to see the course of human history for what it is. I am an archaeologist. I have spent my career attempting to make sense of the past, and I find a world completely at odds with popular misconceptions. Not only is the past I observe not peaceful and pristine, but cruel and ugly as it may be, it provides great insight into the present. We are far better off understanding the past than ignoring it, or believing a mythical version of history that bears little resemblance to what actually took place. While my purpose here is not to rail against my colleagues, it is impossible to ignore the fact that academia has missed what I consider to be some of the essence of human history. The past has been sanitized, and the recorders of history have often cast humans as having lived in ecological and peaceful bliss. LeBlanc, 2003, PPCC. More recently, it appears that digs are showing that man killed and ate Neanderthals, a hint as to their rapid disappearance 50,000 years ago, coincident with our arrival in their habitat. Highly compelling, 2022. Again, politically minded scientists can't cope with this reality. Funnily enough, previous generations in these fields were often ex-military types who took a more realistic view of the evidence. Ideology too often trumps intelligence in the science world, with active measures taken to silence truth-tellers being more common than you would imagine. After a career spent studying the Yanomami tribe in the Amazon, Napoleon Chagnon wrote Noble Savages, Chagnon, 2013. Obviously, even the title was unacceptable, so he was attacked, vilified, and accused by more right-on academics of causing the conflicts and confrontations he recorded. All these semi-professional scientist activists attacking the occasional robust academic like Chagnon find ready publishers in the university presses, but if you step outside the narrative, publication becomes more problematic and the whispering begins as the knives are sharpened. Peer review is much discredited now. See Science Fictions in Chapter 3, looking more like a subtle form of censorship, allowing gatekeepers to control the narrative, and many of our corrupted bookish leaders need to be consigned to the dustbin of history along with their tomes. I trust them as far as I can spit and must read many sources to seek corroboration and the truth, whatever that is these days. As you will see, the elite's tax-exempt foundations fund much of the research and book-writing sabbaticals, only letting through what they want, so there is no need for anything as crass as a public blacklist. As things stand today, original work is that which has not had a bunch of cowed careerists all over it, and if some get through the academic filter, it will probably be published in a less reputable journal or small publishing house. Nevertheless, I never feel disappointed when I have to sift through some thought leader's rubbish because I have come to enjoy identifying regurgitated tripe unconsciously reprinted in some useless volume. I usually counter its effects on my brain by reading older volumes which are generally more honest, if a little dated. However, the dark side to this, and it is not me trying to turn readers into cynics, is that this trend is growing, and the number of students turning into mushrooms, kept in the dark and fed on bullshit, is increasing. Even worse, the age of those being fattened up for the slaughter is lowering. So, let's do a little more digging.